Welcome to Social Design Insights, the weekly podcast which brings you the leading voices of the social design movement. I am Emiliano Gandolfi, your co-host, and I'm here today as usual with my co-host, Eric Kessel.
Hey everyone, great to be back for the second half of this interview.
We're here today with Alfredo Brillenburg and Hubert Klumpner, always of Urban Think Tank. We have been speaking with them about the Empower Shack project in South Africa in the first part of the interview, and we're going on in the second part, getting a bit deeper into the details.
If you didn't check it out, please go to our website and check out the first part of this interview, because it was a fascinating discussion about formality and informality and how structural inequality presents in the built environment. This all began with a question, right, Emiliano? Can we design a slum-friendly city, which is something that you and I encountered in Mumbai last year?
Well, it's something that I think Urban Think Tank is really addressing in a quite interesting way, because they're really looking at how a specific urban environment that is built by its own inhabitants can possibly evolve. So they have been looking at examples in which they have been inserting cultural facilities like a gym, or they have been inserting a building that could be a transport hub, but also that could be a place, like in the project of Caracas, that holds different activities. But also, like in the case of South Africa, they have been looking at how creating dwellings could be a way, a direct development of a neighborhood, especially going beyond this notion of urban conflict and trying to see how people can, in fact, build up opportunities for their own lives.
And I think they do all of this in a term that they refer to as unsolicited, but I think it's more kind of working with grassroots bottom-up organizations. You know, they don't accept top-down commissions or you know, these sorts of high-minded things. They're always working on the street and, you know, building the desire from the project from the ground up.
What is probably also interesting of being unsolicited is that not only that they don't accept commissions, which is something that probably might happen, but it's really the idea is that things, you know, have to evolve from the ground. So it's not about just planning, you know, a neighborhood as a new street, but it's really entering in contact with the direct exigencies of a community and using what they call their toolbox. So using strategies, but also seeing how people can fit in this kind of strategies and in be empowered by a specific idea.
And we're going to hear how they do it. So let's listen to the interview.
You called this project Empower Shack, and I think it's really interesting to see how this housing is creating an opportunity for people that, in fact, are living in shacks and don't see their opportunity into entering into a housing market. However, you guys have been working very much in strategies over informality, and I was wondering what is the, because, I mean, this building is actually a prototype. So how do you see the incremental growth of this small neighborhood in the upcoming years? How do you think that housing can actually spur up development of the entire place?
Well, interesting enough, the way the scheme works is that we have three houses actually that are all paired together with firewalls. It creates a very nice rhythm. It's a cluster of three houses, and they all sit on one lot. In other words, we convince the government, because by observing Alexandria and other settlements in Kailiche, we saw that the RDP house was building back shack houses. Maybe you know about this notion of the back shacker, where they would charge rent and they would build shacks in the back of this RDP formal house. So we convinced the government, let's start from day one to put three units on the same lot of an RDP. And with those three units, we could combine, each unit could be individual, or depending on the growth of the family, depending on the situation, they could grow vertical, or they could combine two houses into one family. So in other words, the incrementality of the house is actually built in to the different schemes of the typology of the three volumes. Sometimes one family will have two volumes, one family will have one volume, one family will have three volumes, depending on their power of purchase and their power of taking microloan credits and the size, literally, of their family.
So it sounds like you're talking about a sort of hybrid formality, and given our question of the month, this idea just to oversimplify things really quick, informality being a condition where people are just left on their own to, you know, design and build with whatever they have around, and formality being a fairly rigid and sometimes unfair system of laws and codes that favor capitalistic development as opposed to human development. What you're describing sounds to me is something in the middle where, you know, people are empowered to design their own environments with the assistance and participation of architects. Would you say that's accurate?
I would say you're right on the ideas, actually, and you already implied it. The idea is actually to formalize the informal and informalize the formal. We have figured out that obviously what is going on in neighborhoods, in so-called slum, in low-income neighborhoods, that the processes, the actor, the agents who operate there are extremely well versed. They know exactly what they do, sometimes with little or no means, but also outside the financial systems. So economy is always a concern to them. I would say we would commit a big error if we would think that informal development is a sort of a development that is without meaning to the formal side. And we have understood and registered better what is actually going on, and therefore we can talk with that system. We can find ways of incorporating it in our more formal way of talking. We can propose how also in the process of building a city, not as an event, which a formal construction company would actually see the business, but as a process that takes longer periods of time, that is actually adjusted to the income and to the possibilities of the people, how cities actually can be built. This is actually the traditional or the way that cities have been emerging over hundreds of years, how we can bring that intelligence back into the equation. And that also relates to our creation of pilot projects and prototypes in our idea to create a new paradigm that incorporates those different streams, those different intelligence lines in very local contexts. They're obviously always very site-specific. You have to deal with idiosyncrasies, with the local culture, the materials, the construction methods, etc. Engage with an infinite number of people, also the labor of really getting it done, and connecting all the dots in that sense has become almost a role for moderation, which is equally strong than the design role, is actually the moderation of these processes. But in that sense, formal and informal is not a dichotomy anymore. We're trying to break this dichotomy actually down, similar to the existing dichotomies of qualitative and quantitative debates in the facilitation of housing or services in cities, similar to the questions of scale. We also believe that in architecture and urban design, scale doesn't matter anymore. We have to work on different registers, up and down, upstream and downstream, the questions of scales, and bring this intelligence back into a process that is producing concrete results that can be experienced on site by the people, where people can buy into in the legal, in the financial, but also in the term of their neighbor and livelihood, to scale and multiply those experiences. And in an ideal way, this relates back to the toolbox to bring the basics of those insights to other places. It is never a recipe that you can transcend or that you can transport into a different context, but there's a sort of a underlying logic that you can apply in different environments, and that is also the value what we as architects can bring into those neighborhoods to bring, translate, and moderate that into built projects.
I saw interestingly, Alfredo, that you also co-directed a play in Cape Town. There were certainly a lot of lessons that you learned from people that actually live in this neighborhood in similar situations in Cape Town. What would be the lessons that you would like to share with us?
After Hubert and I gravitated away from Caracas, where the architect and we were locals, let's say the history of architecture, many firms are made in locality, let's say, whether it be in Chile, Peru, Venezuela, people, Colombia, people are working from their hometown, let's say. We have now been thrown into the permanent wanderer, but when we go and try to do our new experiments wherever we go, or try to do a new prototype project, we have lots of difficulty becoming one with the community and understanding them. And so we've used art and exhibitions and filmmaking and photography and maybe even workshops to get in touch with our neighborhoods, our new neighborhoods. As Hubert said at the very beginning of the of this interview, he said, we went to see if Caracas was everywhere. So we started to use the same methods we used in Caracas. And the play was, yes, new. We had never written a play before. But the play was the consequence of walking the neighborhood, getting to know the people, seeing the incredible artistic output that is in the townships of South Africa, and then meeting an incredible person called Mandisi Sindo, who had a shack theater, the only shack theater in all of South Africa, literally in Khayelitsha, two blocks away from where we were doing our houses. And he said, look, I think you can help me, because although we've done great performances and we have a lot of the community coming to watch our plays in the Shack Theater of Makukani Art Room, we are not known. We're not black actors, are not getting jobs. I think maybe you could help us do a new project that would raise relevance. So at that very moment, I was also toying with the idea, how do I understand the politics of race, black and white in South Africa, the inheritance of apartheid? This was incredibly difficult for me to really start to. And I used the play, it's co-directed with Mandisi Sindo, who is a black man from the township itself. And the assistant directors, Rebecca van der Beek and Umbulele, were also black and white, and a woman, Rebecca, in that case. So we brought gender into it. And together with that, we workshopped the play. An initial idea I had about Gil Scott-Heron's lyrics coming from, you might know Gil Scott-Heron, the first rapper, and maybe a man who spoke to black rights. It came to me when I read on the university walls of Cape Town University, UCT, I read, "The revolution will not be televised." This is a direct quote from one of Gil Scott-Heron's songs. And then I knew that through Gil's plight and writing and singing about the ghettos of the United States and his own plight in Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., and New York, that I could maybe redirect it and reinterpret it through the South African context. And of course, the actors and Mandisi translated it into Xhosa language, and it became a completely fused workshop play, and I would call a very successful experimental theater. We had a run in the town hall in the main theater of Cape Town at the Fringe Festival. We got standing ovations fortuitously, and we won a prize after 8 days of performance. And tomorrow we will be doing a performance of this play with Mandisi Sindo here in Zurich at the Schauspielhaus. You will see it in NZZ. There'll be an article tomorrow morning.
We have been working over the last couple of years in San Patrigiano in the largest drug rehabilitation program in Italy, actually. I'm sure Emiliano is aware
yes,
of it.
Yes, I know it, yes.
Near Rimini, we have been actually working there to develop a project, a housing project inside the rehabilitation program. And in the workshops of San Patrigiano, the dress, the costume design for the play Holy Contract was translated in fantastic outfits that have been shipped down to South Africa and will now come back actually from South Africa on tour to Europe. So I think there's also an incredible dynamic set in motion to not only isolate one project from the next, but how different experiences are feeding into a larger scope, which is for us the work we're doing. It's coming more and more together in one body of work, in a vision, in a strategy, rather than in opportunistic moments of creating out of a piecemeal of opportunities a project by connecting them also and bringing them into the next project, whatever we have produced in one.
Makukani Art Room, which was the only Shack Theatre. We upgraded it for the performance of Holy Contract, but now we're actually doing a proper theater building for them in that same site. So things that begin as an activism or begin as a as maybe an artistic endeavor end up somehow redirected towards our fundamental role as being architects.
You're listening to Social Design Insights with Eric Kessel and Emiliano Gandolfi. We hope you've been enjoying these thoughts from Hubert and Alfredo of Urban Think Tank about how to move from activism into architecture. But we've got to take a quick break. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with more Social Design Insights.
Welcome back to Social Design Insights. Before the break, we have been speaking with Alfredo Brillenburg and Hubert Klumpner about their engagement strategies, particularly looking at how to engage with foreign communities in which it becomes vital to create a common ground. Let's now look at other projects in which Urban Think Tank has been working in Colombia, in a town famous for its carnival. Eric, do you want to proceed with the next question?
All these art projects that you've been discussing, how do they relate to your new project in Barranquilla?
Similar to the work that we have done also and displayed in the last architecture biennale on the museum in Sarajevo, you might have seen, Barranquilla has actually provided us with an opportunity to almost work backwards. We're bringing a project actually to the attention of people who would normally only see it when a project is consolidated, budgeted, and built. We have actually found for ourselves a method to use film, photography, Alfredo alluded to it, theater, to bring actually a project already in a debate into a discussion. The media exhibitions are also platforms that we're using in that way, not to show the final project, but actually to raise attention, to create visibility, to bring people in unison to stuff and finance it, and then to get it done.
In that particular case, it was a strategy that was worked out at the highest formal level at the IDB, Inter-American Development Bank. So it was actually a certain activism of bringing the attention to a group of individuals who are responsible for Barranquilla as a sustainable city, future sustainability. Hubert worked very hard to create the visibility that they had to create a school for the carnival.
So I give you a bit of a framework how that worked in Barranquilla. As you know, the carnival is actually the moment where the roles of the people change. The rich become the poor, they put on their clothes, they interchange their role in society. Everything is upside down. We thought this is a perfect pretext in a country and a city that is marked by 50 years of civil war, by displacement of people. Half of Barranquilla are actually individuals who moved from the south of the country where the FARC, the Revolutionary Army, was active and created this internal displacement. The center of the city is practically abandoned. There are obviously people there, but it is abandoned by businesses, by institutions, etc. And the idea to identify the annual carnival as a moment to bring this society together again was for us a very interesting one. So we visited in the popular areas of town, the workshops, the dance studios, the music and instrument building sites where people actually rehearse dance in open air, in garages, on the open streets, in schools after hours, where they actually improvise something which is an incredible explosion of creativity, a UNESCO non-tangible world heritage, that this Caribbean particular carnival. And we figured out that if we could bring this actually into a format like an art school where people could use those capacities and translate in professions, that we would make an enormous contribution in a society which is practically unemployed and lives in a very difficult situation, finding their place, their ownership in the city again. In a very fragmented society, Colombia has six social strata from 1 to 6. The people who produce this carnival event are actually all in strata 1 and 2, which is poor, $2 daily income up to maybe $3 or $4, to not only make a museum to display the carnival permanently, but to make a place, a workshop, if you want so. We called it Fabrica de Cultura. We found a site in the city, an old tobacco factory called Tabaco, the Colombian tobacco factory, and we added a new open building structure, which is the result of working with those different schools, sculpturing, painting, dance, composition, cooking, all those different disciplines that are necessary to make this carnival happen. And we translated their room requirements, their workshops, their ideas of how to deal and produce this mega event, if you want to call it like that, into a building format, into a permanent showcase, what is actually done for such an event. And this has become the engine, the line along which we developed this art school around.
None of the projects that Urban Think Tank has built came by a phone call. Every one of them was a research endeavor that ended up identifying clients, stakeholders, and identifying money sources. And we put them all together and we connected the desires of the bottom with maybe the influence and power at the top.
Next year, Urban Think Tank will turn 20. And I think that you guys have been doing loads of research, projects, installations, exhibitions. And what is really interesting is that overall, you guys have always been, you know, on the forefront. You always have been in straight contact with communities. You always have been in contact with political entities and institutional entities. What I was wondering to conclude was, what are your recommendations for, the architects that are studying now and that are also part of your studios, that will be, you know, the architects that will be forming societies and dealing with these problems of tomorrow? What is your recommendation in how architects should actually engage in society? Do you think it's always about being unsolicited and being immersed in problems? Or do you think there's something you can advise to make them, you know, active participants in building a better society?
You know, architects have been many things and should be, and there are many types of architects out there. The one thing that we are trying to teach is to become an architect who's concerned about making a difference in society. And as you know, the great works of architecture, if you analyze them, have always had a vision about society. So you can build a beautiful building anywhere in the world you want, with a beautiful facade, glassy facade, beautiful details, Norman Foster or whoever you want. But if that building doesn't have a critical attitude towards something that tries to reflect the society and the time that we're living in, that building will be forgotten in 20 years.
I would also add a lot of the work that we have done was met with raised eyebrows, with questions of for whom we are doing this, how the budget will ever come across to realize this, how we can get a match between the programs that we identified, often the lack of land where to put a project, very pragmatic realities, obviously, and identify the ownership also of people finally to use this project, to guarantee also that it is actually making this difference that Alfredo has talked about it, that people are appropriating it, that they operate it, that they run it. Our first vertical gym, for instance, a fantastic testimony of it. I think as an architect, you also have to follow not only what you have learned, but also what you yourself, your partners, your friends, and your community around you might see as something which is wrong, as something which is controversial. But if you believe in it, if you have the energy to stick with it, to go through it and get things done, if you have the breath, the time, and the endurance to make things done despite the doubts of others. I think that is also the space where architecture that makes a difference is created. It is not in the mainstream. It is not in the magazines. It's not in the history books. It is here and now, and it needs to be, just as Alfredo says, an answer to the circumstances we find ourselves in. This is where the architecture sits for us, and this is also what we're trying to teach an increasing number of students and fellow researchers in this idea of urban think tank here at ETH Zurich, also in our practice, how architecture can be done that has a relevance today in the world.
Wow. I think that's an amazing place to close and a very important message for our listeners to take in. So hopefully they can press rewind and listen to that a couple of times, because I think you really hit it on the head.
So maybe I just add one thing, is that we've been consistent, and consistency is fundamental. You've got to have a belief. You've got to take responsibility for your architecture. Architects have been complicit with the divisions of cities. And so the next time you make a decision as a young architect, you have to understand who you're making that decision for. And you should align yourself with the right decision, because there always is a right decision.
Emiliano, I also want to congratulate you and the Curry Stone team for the decision. Very, very courageous to identify people, because it has also been an interesting journey for us to meet a lot of friends and new friends who are in this group of people. And I think there's a moment also to constitute this group of people into something more than a loose network of individuals that have identified the social turn in their work, but who also have translated that in design, in architecture. And that's interesting for us also to follow with you.
10 years ago in Informal City, if you read the epilogue, the last paragraph in our book, Informal City, you will see that we said we were going to try and reconnect with the experiments of the 60s and 70s, especially in Team 10, which, as you know, was a lot of people who had the same ideals to break with the Siam, and they would come together every so often. And I think that what you're doing is actually creating another kind of larger Team 100. And maybe we should all get together and get more political.
Absolutely. I'm really glad you're saying this, because when we started this venture, it was really an urgency for us to recognize a movement of people that sometime are working in an invisible way, in many cases unsolicited, in many geographies. But in the overall scale, they're actually having a huge impact, at least in terms of inspiration to communities that are, having better access to basic needs. Well, thank you very much, Hubert and Alfredo. I really hope we can get together one day with all the 100 Social Design Circle members. You know, maybe in Zurich. Let's work for this.
It's necessary. It's become necessary with recent events, I would think.
Yeah.
If not, we won't have a political voice. That's the power of it, because the profession really is now lost. And I'm not the only one who says it. There's a new generation who doesn't quite know how to fit in.
Alfredo, Hubert, once more, thank you for sharing with our listeners all this amazing wisdom. I know that it took you years to retain all this knowledge. Let's hope the next generation can profit from this pioneering work and just move ahead. This is all for today. If you enjoyed this conversation, you will certainly find more inspiration on our website, www.currystonedesignprize.com, and following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Thank you for listening to Social Design Insights.